VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English. On today's program, Jonathan and I bring you stories along with Dan Friedel and Dan Novak. Jill Robbins answers a question from an English learner in Spain. We close with part two of Jack London's The Law of Life. But first, as Vietnam prepares to celebrate the Year of the Tiger on February 1st, artist Nguyen Dan Phat is busy creating hundreds of tigers to mark the Lunar New Year. Over the next few months, Phat aims to make 2,022 tigers from wood and red clay. Phat often creates art with the 12 animals of the lunar calendar, but he said he is especially drawn to the tiger this year. "I am very fond of tigers as an animal, as they are so powerful yet so majestic," Phat said. The 39-year-old artist talked with Reuters reporters from his home and work area in Dung Lam, a village just north of Hanoi. His tiger sculptures are made from local materials. The materials include wood from the jackfruit tree and a clay-like substance commonly used in buildings in the area. He also uses crushed eggshells and seashells to form markings on the surface of some sculptures. Phat said it takes about 6 weeks to complete one tiger. He must paint and then cover the sculptures in a protective substance. He works on several tigers at a time and employs two or three people to help him. As of January 25th, Phat had finished more than 800 tigers. Once he is fully finished, he plans to show all 2,022 tigers at a special event. Then he plans to sell them. The Lunar New Year, known as Tet in Vietnam, will look different than usual years. Officials in both Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City say there will be no traditional fireworks shows because of COVID-19 concerns.
An emotional Rafael Nadal said he feels like his tennis career was alive again after reaching the final of the Australian Open on Friday. Nadal's victory over Italian Matteo Berrettini left him one win away from a record-breaking 21st Grand Slam championship. A few months ago, the 35-year-old Spaniard feared he might never play again because of a serious foot injury. He missed several major competitions last year, including Wimbledon, the Olympics, and the U.S. Open. Nadal also struggled with COVID-19 infection last month. He said he told his family and team members, if things continue like this, maybe it's a chance to say goodbye. But on Friday, Nadal recorded his 10th straight win to reach his 6th Australian Open final. Nadal could not stop crying after his victory Friday, saying, "I feel alive in terms of my tennis life, in terms of my tennis career." Nadal is currently in a three-way tie with Serbian Novak Djokovic and Roger Federer of Switzerland for the men's Grand Slam record at 20. Federer has been out for some time with injuries, while top-ranked Djokovic had to leave Australia when his visa was cancelled. A victory in the final on Sunday would give Nadal the record. But he will need to defeat the world's second-ranked player, Daniil Medvedev of Russia. Medvedev defeated Djokovic earlier in the U.S. Open final to prevent Djokovic from breaking the record. This final will be Nadal's 29th Grand Slam final of his career. He has won a record 13 French Open championships. But he has only won one Australian Open title in his career. That win came in 2009. Nadal said of Sunday's final, "For me, it's a present just to be here and play tennis."
The California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco believes it has the world's oldest living fish in an aquarium. The fish is an Australian lungfish, and it lives in a glass container in a museum. The San Francisco Chronicle newspaper first wrote about the fish in 1947. The story said the fish looked strange and might have been an example of the link between animals that lived in the ocean and those that lived on land. The fish is named Methuselah, after a person said to have lived 969 years in the Bible. While she is not that old, biologists at the aquarium think the fish is about 90 years old. They believe it is the oldest living example of a lungfish in an aquarium. Until a few years ago, the oldest Australian lungfish was at the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago. But that fish, named Grandad, died in 2017 at the age of 95. By default, said biologist Alan Jan, Methuselah is the oldest. Jan looks after the fish in San Francisco. He believes the fish is female but does not know for sure. The aquarium plans to take a very small part of the fish's fin and send it to scientists in Australia. The scientist will try to confirm the fish's age and sex. Jan said Methuselah likes getting rubbed on her back. He compared her to an underwater puppy or young dog. She is a little longer than 1 meter and weighs about 20 kilograms. Jeanette Peach is a spokeswoman for the aquarium. She said the fish enjoys eating fresh figs, a type of fruit. She won't eat them when they're frozen, Peach said. The aquarium has two other Australian lungfish. Jan said they are thought to be in their 40s or 50s. The species is now threatened and can no longer be exported from Australian waters. So getting another lungfish after Methuselah is not likely. We just give her the best possible care we can provide, and hopefully she thrives, Jan said. I'm Dan Friedel.
The cost of a well-loved snack in Japan is increasing for the first time in over 40 years. Umaibo corn puff was introduced in Japan in 1979. Its name means delicious stick. People have loved Umaibo for many years for its special crunch and its 10 yen price. 1 Japanese yen is less than 1 US cent, or 1/100 of a dollar. The maker of Umaibo, Yaokin Corporation, is increasing the price to 12 yen. The snack's first ever price increase will begin in April. The price change is a reminder that Japan is feeling the effects of rising costs of raw materials and transportation. Prices of goods have been rising in many countries, but Japanese companies have so far avoided increasing prices out of fear of losing buyers. Longtime fans of Umaibo are surprised and saddened by the cost change. Umaibo have been the same price for so long, so a 2 yen increase is a big deal, 59-year-old Noriko Ida told Reuters. I was surprised. Umaibo come in 15 flavors or tastes, such as cheese, seasoned fish egg, and creamy corn soup. Around 700 million of the crunchy sticks are sold each year. The cost has stayed so low that even children can buy themselves Umaibo. For many Japanese, the snack reminds them of when they were young. Takeshi Nemoto has been in charge of purchasing snacks at Tokyo snack shop Kawahara Shoten for many years. He said other snack manufacturers may also have to raise prices. There's nothing we can do, he said. From the manufacturer's point of view, they can't stay profitable anymore unless they raise the price. Some fans of Umaibo saw the change as the end of an era. We are witnessing a turning point of history, rock musician Atsushi Osawa said on Twitter. His band, Uchikubi Gokumon Dokokai, included the snack in a 2010 song. They sang about Umaibo's miracle price. The musician said, the price has started to diverge from the lyrics.
Experts warn that climate change is threatening the Winter Olympics and the future of snow sports. Warmer weather is also making conditions much more dangerous for athletes and others. The warning came in a report published a week before the 2022 Winter Games in Beijing begin on February 4th. The Games will be the first Winter Olympics to use almost 100% artificial snow. More than 400 snowmaking machines are being used to cover the ski area. The report said that making artificial snow uses a lot of energy, water, and chemicals. The researchers said the artificial snow also creates what many competitors call unpredictable and dangerous conditions. The report came from the Sport Ecology Group at Loughborough University in England and the Protect Our Winters Environment Group, based in Boulder, Colorado. The Beijing Organizing Committee has released its own report. It said the game's smart snowmaking system could use 20% less water than traditional methods. The organizers said the games will not put pressure on local water supplies. Instead, they said melted mountain water will be used along with rainfall collected during the summer. The research noted that climate change reduces the amount of natural snowfall in many areas of the world. There is also less water available to create artificial snow, putting the entire snow sports industry at risk. Competitors often must deal with unpredictable snow seasons, the research said. Climate change is also reducing the number of places that can host the Winter Games. The risk is clear. Man-made warming is threatening the long-term future of winter sports, the report said. There have been 21 hosts of the Winter Olympics since the 1924 Games at the French resort of Chamonix. Researchers estimated that by 2050, only 10 will have the climate suitability and natural snowfall levels to host the event. Chamonix is now rated high risk, along with places in Norway, France, and Austria. Vancouver in Canada, Sochi in Russia, and Squaw Valley in the United States are considered unreliable. I'm Dan Novak.
This week on Ask a Teacher, we answer a question from La Mancha, Spain. Hello, VOA. I was wondering about the difference between stand and stay. Are they synonyms? Felix in Spain. Dear Felix, thank you for asking us this question. The two words do seem to be similar, but there is an important difference between them. Let us begin with the verb stand. For a human, it means to be in an upright position with your weight on your feet. When you stand, you do not move much. Here's an example.
The employee's feet hurt because she was standing most of the day.
We can use stand for non-living as well as living things.
The streetlight stands beside the path to my house.
Another meaning of stand is to move from a sitting position to a standing position.
Please stand to sing the national anthem.
There are many other uses of stand with prepositions or as a noun, but we will not worry about them here. Compare stand now with the verb stay. To stay means to continue to be in the same place for a period of time. You could use remain in the same way as stay in many cases. Stay and remain both describe a living thing that has a choice of moving to another location. For example,
we have to stay at home to work to avoid infection. The soccer player stayed off the field for the whole game.
We also can use stay to talk about continuing in a state or condition or position.
Raina and Alex stayed friends for years after they left school. I could not stay awake during the math lecture today.
You can also use stay to talk about living in a place as a guest for a short period.
Mahmoud stayed at the Ramses Hotel for a month while he worked in Cairo.
When you are trying to decide whether to use stay or stand, please ask yourself, can the subject change its location? Will the verb remain work? Here is a statement you can use to test our method.
A fruit tree
blank
beside the school wall.
We know that a tree cannot move by itself, and it does not choose to remain by the wall. So we should use stands in that statement. What question do you have about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Jill Robbins.
The Law of Life by Jack London, Part 2.
Koshkush placed another stick on the fire and let his thoughts travel deeper into the past. There was the time of the great famine. He had lost his mother in that famine. In the summer, the usual plentiful catch of fish had failed, and the tribe looked forward to the winter and the coming of the caribou. Then the winter came, but with it there were no caribou. Never had the like been known, not even in the lives of the old men. The rabbits had not produced any young, and the dogs were skin and bone. And through the long darkness the children wept and died. So did the women and the old men. Not one in ten lived to meet the sun when it returned in the spring. That was a famine. But he had seen times of plenty, too, when the meat spoiled before it could be eaten. Even the dogs grew fat and were worth nothing from eating too much. In these times they let the animals and birds go unkilled, and the tents were filled with newly born children. Then it was that the men remembered old quarrels and crossed to the south and to the west to kill ancient enemies. He remembered when a boy, during a time of plenty, when he saw a moose pulled down by the wolves. Zingha lay with him in the snow and watched. Zingha was his friend, who later became the best of hunters. One day he fell through an air hole in the frozen Yukon River. They found him, a month later, frozen to the ice where he had attempted to climb out. Zingha and he had gone out that day to play at hunting in the manner of their fathers. Near a creek they discovered the fresh track of a moose, and with it the tracks of many wolves.
"An old one," Zingha said. "It is an old one who cannot travel as fast as the others. The wolves have separated him from his brothers, and they will never leave him."
And it was so. It was their way. By day and by night, never resting, biting at his heels, they would stay with him to the end. How Zingha and he had felt the desire to see blood! The finish would be a sight to remember. Eagerly they started up the trail. Even he, Koshkush, who was not a good tracker, could have followed it blind, it was so wide. They were not far behind the hunt, reading its awful story at every step. Now they saw where the moose had stopped to face his attackers. On every side the snow had been stamped heavily. In the middle there were the deep footprints of the moose. All about, everywhere, were the lighter footmarks of the wolves. Some had moved to one side and rested while their brothers tried to seize the moose. The full-stretched impressions of their bodies in the snow were as perfect as though they'd been made a moment before. One wolf had been caught in a wild dash at the moose and had died under its heavy stamping. A few bones remained as witness. The two boys stopped again at a second stand. Here the great animal had fought with despair. As the snow indicated, he had been dragged down twice, and twice he shook off his enemies and gained his footing once more. He had finished his task long before, but nevertheless, life was dear to him. Zingha said it was a strange thing for a moose once down to struggle free again. But this one certainly had done so. The medicine man would see signs and wonders in this when they told him. Then they came to the place where the moose had tried to climb the river bank and go into the woods. But his enemies had attacked from behind, until he leaped high and then fell back upon them, crushing too deep into the snow. It was clear that the kill was near because the two dead wolves had been left untouched by their brothers. The trail was red with blood now, and the distance between the tracks of the great beast had become shorter and shorter. Then they heard the first sounds of the battle, the quick bark of the wolves which spoke of teeth-tearing flesh. On hands and knees, Zingha and Kashkush made their way through the snow. Together they pushed aside the low branches of a young pine tree and looked forth. It was the end that they saw. The picture, like all of youth's memories, was still strong with him. His eyes now watched the end acted again as clearly as in that earlier time. Kashkush was surprised at this, because in the days which followed he had done many great deeds. He had been the leader of men, and his name had become a curse in the mouths of his enemies. For a long time he recalled the days of his youth, until the fire grew cold and the frost bit deeper. He placed two sticks on the fire this time. Then he figured how much life was left by the amount of wood that remained in the pile. If Sitkamha had remembered her grandfather and gathered a larger armful, his hours would have been longer. It would have been easy, but she was always a selfish child. She had not honored her ancestors from the time the beaver, son of Zingha, first looked at her. Ah, well, what did it matter? Had he not done the same in his own quick youth? For a while he listened to the silent forest. Perhaps the heart of his son might soften. Then he would return with the dogs to take his old father with the tribe to where the caribou ran thick and the fat hung heavy upon them. He strained his ears. There was not a sound to be heard. Nothing. He alone took breath in the middle of the great stillness. It was very lonely. Wait. What was that? His body suddenly felt cold. A familiar cry broke the silent air, and it was close to him. Then his darkened eyes again saw the old moose, the bloody sides, the torn legs, and the great branching horns fighting to the last. He saw the flashing forms of gray, the bright eyes, the dripping tongues and the sharp teeth. And he saw the circle move closer until it became a dark point in the middle of the stamped snow. A cold nose pushed against his face, and at its touch his soul leaped back to the present. His hand shot into the fire and dragged out a burning stick. Overcome for the moment by his fear of man, the beast drew back, raising a call to his brothers. Greedily they answered, until a ring of gray was stretched around him. The old man listened to the steady breathing of this circle. He waved his flaming stick wildly, but the beasts refused to scatter. Now one moved slowly forward, dragging his legs behind. Now a second, now a third. But now, not one moved back from his flaming stick. Why should he so desire life, he asked, and dropped the burning stick into the snow. It made a slight noise, and then there was no more fire. The circle murmured uncertainly, but held its place. Again he saw the last stand of the old moose, and Kashkush dropped his head hopelessly on his knees. What did it matter? Was it not the law of life?
And that's our program for today.
Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan.